and then sit in boredom as the speech stumbles to an anticlimax. Too soon? When a speech begins with its meaning and then rattles on, interest quickly wanes. Readers skim over the words that follow, audiences tune out. To skillfully time the meaning of each line, follow the guiding principles we previously covered. Economy and design. 1. Say the maximum in the fewest possible words. 2. Master the three basic sentence designs. Cumulative, balanced, suspense. So you can place meaning wherever you think best, beginning, middle, or end. Mistimed cues. A scene finds its natural rhythm of action-reaction in the give and take of meaning. Until a character has some sense of what was just said, of what just happened, he waits in limbo. But the instant character A senses, or thinks he senses, what character B is saying or doing, he reacts. Although most reactions seem instinctive, spontaneous, and instantaneous, they are in fact triggered by a glimpse of meaning. Character A may completely misinterpret the moment and overreact, underreact, or react off the wall. Nonetheless, his reaction, indeed every reaction, needs an action to prompt it. Therefore, ideally, the last word or phrase of each speech is the core word that seals meaning and cues a reaction from the other side of the scene. On page, mistiming the core word is a relatively minor problem, but in the theater or on a soundstage, it can break scenic rhythm and ruin performances. A miscue happens when a core word is placed too early in character A's line and prompts a reaction from character B, but because character A has more words to recite, actor B must swallow her response and wait while actor A finishes performing his speech. To make cueing technique clear, let's work with this passage adapted from Act 1, Scene 5 of John Pielmeyer's play Agnes of God. Sister Agnes, a young nun, has given birth inside a convent. The newborn's dead body was found in a waste paper basket next to Agnes's blood-soaked bed. Agnes claims to be a virgin. Some weeks prior to Agnes's giving birth, a hole appeared in the palm of Agnes's hand. The convent's mother superior wants to believe that these events are the work of God. The police suspect that Agnes committed neonaticide, and so the court has appointed Dr. Martha Livingston, a psychiatrist, to determine Agnes's sanity. After examining Agnes, the doctor and mother superior talk. As you listen to this passage, notice how the line structure places the core word or phrase at or near the end of speeches. This technique creates crisp cueing and a well-paced rhythm of action-reaction.
Look, I know what you're thinking. She's an hysteric, pure and simple. Not simple, no. I saw the hole, clean through the palm of her hand. Do you think hysteria did that? It's been doing it for centuries. She's not unique, you know. She's just another victim. Yes, God's victim. That's her innocence. She belongs to God. And I mean to take her away from him. Isn't that what you fear? You bet I do. Well, I prefer to look upon it as opening her mind so she can begin to heal. But that's not your job, is it? You're here to diagnose, not to heal. I'm here to help her in whatever way I see fit. That's my duty as a doctor. But not as an employee of the court. You're here to make a decision on her sanity as quickly as possible. Not as possible as quickly as I see fit. The kindest thing you can do for Agnes is to make that decision and let her go. And what then? If I say she's crazy, she goes to an institution. If I say she's sane, she goes to prison.
Now, I'll rephrase the lines and move their core words back into the middle of each speech. Notice how the overall meaning stays more or less the same, but the cueing stumbles. The actions, reactions seem to spasm, and the scene staggers along.
Look, she's in hysteric, pure and simple. I know what you're thinking. No, not simple. Clean through the palm of her hand. Do you think hysteria did that? I saw the hole. It's been doing it for centuries. She's just another victim. She's not unique, you know. Yes, she belongs to God. God's victim. That's her innocence. Is that what you fear? That I mean to take her away from him? I do, you bet. Well, opening her mind so she can begin to heal is how I prefer to look upon it. You're not here to heal, but to diagnose. That's your job, isn't it? My duty as a doctor is to help her in whatever way I see fit. You're here to make a decision on her sanity as quickly as possible as an employee of the court. As quickly as I see fit, not as possible. Make that decision and let her go. That's the kindest thing you can do for Agnes. And what then? She goes to prison if I say she's sane. She goes to an institution if I say she's crazy.
When actors encounter scenes of this kind, one of three things will happen. Actors will cut off each other's lines, talk over each other, or phony up their performance by politely and unnaturally waiting for each speech to end. None of these options solves the problem of mistimed cues. Generally, speeches that end with cumulative sentences cause miscues. Before your scenes reach performance, act them aloud into a recorder and listen for the core words. Then go through the lines again, this time with a highlighter, and mark the core words, paying special attention to the last sentence of each speech. You will see that some phrases, especially prepositional phrases, tend to float to the ends of lines, just as they did in my last sentence. If so, cut or rephrase so that each speech ends on its cue. Misshapen scenes. Faulty designs may also infect scenes. Like a misshapen line that mistimes its core word, a misshapen scene can mistime its turning point, bringing it in too soon or too late or not at all. A well-shaped scene pivots around its turning point in just the right way at just the right moment. From story to story, the right moment for any scene's turning point is unpredictable and idiosyncratic. Nevertheless, when timing misfires, the reader or audience feels it. Too soon. The first beat powerfully jolts the scene around its turning point, but from that moment on, the scene runs anticlimactically downhill as characters pour out exposition. For example, a scene we'll call The Lover's Breakup. Version 1. In the first beat, one lover declares the relationship over, the other agrees. The action-reaction of this immediate turning point swings the value charge of love from positive to negative. A beat of resolution may need to follow, but if the scene goes on and on as the lovers pour out their history, reminiscing about the good times and lamenting the bad, the reader or audience may turn against the scene and its characters thinking, "You guys are done. Get over it." Too late. Repetitious beats of dialogue prattle on far too long until sometime after the audience has lost interest, the turning point finally arrives. Version 2. Lovers whose relationship has run its course reminisce about the good times and lament the bad until the audience sees the turning point coming long before it arrives. When the lovers finally agree to break up, the unsurprised audience sits there thinking, I saw this coming 10 minutes ago. Not at all. Version 3. A couple, floating in the doldrums of their relationship, reminisce about the good times and lament the bad. They never take an action to either break up or recommit. The value of love is at the same tepid temperature it was when the scene opened. None of the beats executes a turning point. The beats may zigzag in conflict, but the scene still has no shape, no arc, because the charge of its core value at the end of the scene is exactly what it was at the beginning of the scene. If nothing changes, nothing happens. The scene is a repetitious non-event, leaving the audience to sit in wonder, asking, what was the point of all that talk? As you compose beats of dialogue, give thought to the scene's shape. Build it beat by beat, line by line, progressively to and around the turning point, timing that pivotal beat for the perfect moment. You must decide how sharply or gradually a scene progresses. Your judgment guides what's too soon or too late. Every scene has a life of its own, and you have to feel your way to its ideal shape. Splintered scenes. Scenes flow with life when the reader or audience senses a unity between the character's inner motivations and outer tactics. No matter how subtle, indirect, or disguised their maneuvers may be, somehow what the characters say and do links back to their underlying desires. Scenes splinter and die for the converse reason. We sense a breakdown between what drives the scene from the subtext and what is said and done on the text, a disconnect between inner intentions and outer behaviors. As a result, the scene strikes us as false. I can think of 4 reasons that an otherwise promising scene rambles out of joint and the dialogue seems phony or lifeless. 1. The inner desires are fully motivated, but the dialogue is too bland, and so the scene falls flat. 2. The inner wishes are weakly motivated, but the dialogue is overwrought, and so the scene feels melodramatic. 3. The inner intentions and outer actions seem irrelevant to one another, and so the scene makes no sense, and dialogue ricochets into non sequitur. 4. The characters' desires run side by side, never crossing in conflict. Without conflict, the scene has no turning point, and so nothing changes. Without change, dialogue thickens with exposition, the scene flattens into a non-event, and we sit bored at best, confused at worst. The writers of non-events often try to conceal their ineptitude behind excessive language. Profanity is the common choice. They think that by inserting expletives into tepid dialogue, they raise the dramatic temperature. They would be wrong. Not, as Seinfeld would remind us, that there's anything wrong with profanity per se. Certain settings demand profanity. In long-form crime series like Deadwood, The Wire, or The Sopranos, profanity fits the characters like a silk suit. In fact, when criminals stop swearing, we know they mean business. A silent gangster is a lethal gangster. To reshape a faulty scene, start at either level, subtext or text. You could work from the outside of it by rewriting the line and then backtracking to create an inner action to fit. Or you could work from the inside out by going down into the inner life of your characters and layer by layer rebuild their deep psychologies and desires from the subtext outward into the scene's actions and reactions, sayings and doings. This process demands hard work and time, but because the inside-out method is more difficult, its successes are more powerful. The paraphrasing trap. Novice writers want to believe that writing problems are word problems, and so when they sense the need to rewrite, they start by paraphrasing faulty dialogue over and over. The more they rephrase, the more on the nose their language becomes, until subtext vanishes and the scene is irredeemably dull and false. When scenes fail, the fault is rarely in the words. The solution will be found deep within event and character design. Dialogue problems are story problems. Parts 1 and 2 mapped out the complexities of dialogue. Part 3 takes on the task of imagining and refining dialogue to serve your characters and their story. Part 3. Creating Dialogue. Chapter 10. Character-Specific Dialogue. The Two Talents. Creative writing calls on two sources of creativity, story talent and literary talent. Story talent converts daily existence into meaningful, emotionally moving events and characters, then sculpts a work's inner design, what happens and to whom, to create metaphors for life. Literary talent converts everyday talk into expressive dialogue, then sculpts verbal designs, what's said and to whom, to create metaphors for talk. These two talents combine to shape scenes. Drawing on both talents, fine writers employ an iceberg technique. To drive their story, they submerge the massive content of unspoken thoughts, feelings, desires, and actions out of sight in the subtext of scenes. To tell their story, they create a text of words on the visible tip of character behavior. Let's step back to the time those voices first spoke. Homer, the earliest storyteller we know by name, recited more than 250,000 words of description and dialogue in the Iliad and the Odyssey from memory. With the invention of the alphabet around 800 BC, his epics were written down and the first dialogue appeared on page. Homer's characters argue and accuse each other. They recount the past and predict the future. But, despite the blind poet's image-rich rhyming couplets, their speeches tend toward declamations rather than conversations. As a result, although the choices and actions of his characters express their individuality, in dialogue they sound remarkably alike. In this same period, the first on-stage performances were sacred rituals, in which choruses sang, danced, and chanted verse stories of gods and heroes. Religious ritual slowly evolved into theater as the chorus leader stepped forward to become an actor with a distinguishable character. The playwright Aeschylus introduced a second actor and invented the technique of rapid, face-to-face exchanges of short speeches known as stichomythia, literally line talk, from sticho meaning line, mythos meaning talk. The rhythmic intensity of characters alternating single lines or phrases, combined with quick, biting language, unleashed great dramatic power, as in Aeschylus's play Agamemnon. But it was the introduction of the third actor by Sophocles in plays like Oedipus Rex, Antigone, and Electra that gave rise to character complexity. Sophocles transformed ancient archetypes such as king, queen, princess, warrior, and messenger into characters with personality, dimensionality, and singular voices. What these first playwrights sensed, and what writers of all story media have understood since, is that the more complex the psychology of a character, the more distinctive his dialogue must become. In other words, originality in character design finds its final expression in character-specific dialogue. Consider, for example, this exchange between Matthew McConaughey's detective Rustin Spencer, Rust Cole, and Woody Harrelson's detective Martin Eric, Marty Hart, from the television series True Detective. As they watch an old-fashioned tent revival in rural Louisiana, Rust turns to Marty and says,
"What do you think is the average IQ of this group, huh? What do you see up there on your high horse? What do you know about these people?" "Just observations and deduction. I see a propensity for obesity, poverty, a yen for fairy tales, folks putting what few bucks they do have in a little wicker basket that's being passed around. I think it's safe to say nobody here's going to be splitting the atom, Marty. You see that? Your fucking attitude. Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beaten off to murder manuals. Some folks enjoy community, the common good. If the common good's got to make up fairy tales, then it's not good for anybody."
The scene focuses the Rust-Marty conflict through a trialogue. In this scene, the revivalist congregation becomes the third thing, allowing word choices to distinguish Rust from Marty in two ways. First, their conflicting attitudes toward the congregation. Rust feels contempt, Marty compassion. Rust criticizes them, Marty forgives. Second, Rust's logical intellectualizations versus Marty's emotional personalizations. Rust keeps his cool, Marty loses his. As a result, Rust's phrasings run noticeably slower and longer than Marty's. Compare these two lines. Rust: "Just observations and deductions. I see a propensity for obesity, poverty, a yen for fairy tales." Marty: "Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beating off to murder manuals." Note Rust's abstract polysyllabic terms with Latinate suffixes of ion and ity versus Marty's concrete images in iams and trochees: alone, empty, murder. Showrunner Nick Pizzolatto's precise word choices contrast the loner Rust and his need for justice against the gregarious Marty and his need for intimacy. Crafting idiosyncratic speech, however, does not mean tricking up a role with vocal quirks. A self-conscious stylishness can be like bad acting, the literary equivalent of hamming it up and hogging the spotlight. Panache may impress us, but a true voice affects us. The former calls attention to itself. The latter calls us to life. Contemporary writing workshops often stress development of an inimitable presence in language known as a voice. To me, this talk seems pointless. A writer's style, or so-called voice, cannot be found or created self-consciously. Voice is not a choice, it's a result. A distinctive writing style pays off when a creative personality embraces a broad and deep knowledge of the human condition. When talent wraps its arms around content, the tumultuous coupling that follows breeds a singular manner of expression. Voice is the instinctive, spontaneous consequence of genius working up a sweat. In other words, as you explore your story's content of role, meaning, emotion, and action, as you do the hard work that brings life to your characters, you will write as only you would. That, for better or worse, like it or not, will be your voice. And like a painter covering canvas after canvas through decades of toil in search of his vision, your evolution toward a true voice will take time. In writing dialogue, the same principle applies. When an original character reaches inside for expression, her voice will be the second nature consequence of her one-of-a-kind personality, experience, knowledge, locution, and accent. Ideally, a character's language is so plausible, so seemingly natural, so idiosyncratic, that every line in every scene seems to be an improvisation that no one but that specific character in that specific moment would invent. In saying this, I am not advocating difference for the sake of difference. Quirkiness is not originality, and it takes taste to know the difference. The ability to tell a true phrase from a clever phrase does not come easy. If it's not innate, it must be learned over years of reading and rereading quality novels while watching and rewatching exceptional television, films, and theater. As you hone your judgment of story and character, one insight shifts into sharp focus. The foremost facet of dialogue is vocabulary. Dramatized storytelling is not about the words, but the characters using the words as they struggle through life. All components of speech, from grammar to phrasing to pace, are therefore vital to dialogue. But nothing conveys or betrays personality as much as a character's choice of words, the names of things that live within him. Vocabulary and characterization. As noted in previous chapters, nouns name objects, verbs name actions. A character's vocabulary names what he knows, what he sees, and what he feels. His choice of words is all important because a character's facade of talk should be a doorway to his depths. Passive, blurry, generic phrases flatten a character and numb the audience. Active, concrete, sensory language arouses insights that weave dimension and complexity into a character. To create a brilliant surface of talk that leads the audience into a character's depths, your method must move in the reverse direction. Start within your character, then work outward from content to form to effect. First, draw on your sensory and visual powers to imagine content, what your character sees and feels on the inscape, the unsaid and unsayable. Then craft his dialogue, the said, into a form that slips his words into the reader's or the audience's ear with effect. In essence, you must transform the images in your character's inner life into the verbiage of his outer talk. The principle of creative limitation. The tougher the technique, the more brilliant the feat. Constraint, discipline, and limitation inspire stunning creative achievement. Unrestrained freedom, on the other hand, usually ends in a sprawl. If you take an easy, undisciplined path that makes little claim on your talent, the results smudge with paint-by-numbers banality. But if, contrarily, you choose an arduous technique that demands a master's proficiency, then talent builds muscle until your imagination, strained to the tearing point, explodes with power. The great difficulties imposed by creative limitations are why a Beethoven symphony transcends whistling, why Whistler's mother surpasses a doodle, why a high school prom is not the Bolshoi. The strategy of surrounding yourself with aesthetic obstacles to compel creative excellence begins by pitting language against image. Language is the medium of conscious thought. Image is the medium of subconscious thought. Therefore, writing the first banal phrases that pop to mind is far easier than expressing character in lucid three-dimensional imagery found in the far reaches of your imagination. When you write off the top of your head, all characters sound alike, and the sounds they make irritate like fingernails on a blackboard. Their grating voices fake life and then fill the sham with irredeemably false dialogue, out of character, out of scene, void of feeling, void of truth. Dialogue takes work. Compare the effort to bring someone to mind with words, my cousin Judy, to the task of first conjuring up a glowing image of your cousin, her Alice blue eyes, the almost Asian shape they take when she smiles, then holding her living picture before your mind while you rummage through your vocabulary, searching for the perfect words to make your vision of Judy shine in the mind of your readers. Writing vividly for the outer eye and ear of the spectator, or for the inner eye and ear of the reader, demands fierce concentration. The language-bound art of writing aims its effects at the mental cortex that deciphers words. To tell a story in pure image runs contrary to writing's psycholinguistic nature. Therefore, the masters of page, stage, and screen dedicate their lives to doing exactly that. They choose the strenuous, indeed, next to impossible technique. To inspire excellence, to create insightful, original telling, the dedicated writer condemns himself to chain gang labor, a long dig down the back roads of the unconscious in search of vigorous, deep image language. Sensory dialogue resonates with the speaker's inner life. Specific, vivid, image-rich language leads the reader or audience to the character's subtext of hidden, unconscious thoughts and feelings. As a result, when such characters take verbal actions in pursuit of their desires, they become transparent and we can know them in depth. But when characters sound like a business report, generic, literal, Latinate, polysyllabic, their language flattens the action and diminishes the scene's inner life. The more opaque the characters become, the more we lose interest. Therefore, even if a character is in fact a bore, his dialogue must express his lifeless soul with vivid dreariness. Locution and characterization. Character-specific locutions depend upon both sides of a sentence, subject and predicate. Subject, what or whom the sentence is about, and predicate, something about the subject, combine to create a line of dialogue that helps express two primary dimensions of characterization, knowledge and personality. One aspect of the line tends to convey the former, the other the latter. Although characterization can be expressed through dialogue in a variety of ways, a character's knowledge tends to be expressed in the names of things, nouns and verbs, while a character's personality tends to be expressed in the modifiers that color those nouns and verbs. Knowledge. If a character uses a vague phrase such as a big nail, We sense that his knowledge of carpentry is limited. Generic nouns suggest ignorance. But if he names the thing, shank, clout, spike, corker, sinker, we sense a much fuller knowledge. The same principle applies to verbs. Core verbs, as opposed to modal verbs, span from the generic to the specific. If a character remembers that someone moved slowly across the room, we sense that his recall is dull. Generic verbs also suggest ignorance. But if his dialogue sharpens, and he says that another man sauntered, waltzed, padded, slouched, moseyed, pranced, or dragged himself across the room, his choice of verb suggests a vivid memory and insight into the other man. Specific names of objects and actions convey a superior mentality. Personality. The idiosyncratic byproducts of a character's life experience, his beliefs, his attitudes, his individuality, are chiefly expressed through modifiers. First, adjectives. Two characters look at a fireworks display. One describes it as big, the other as stupendous. These are two very different personalities. Second, adverbs. Two characters watch a motorcycle go by. One says it was going by ferociously, and the other says it was moving quickly. Again, two very different people. Third, voice. Core verbs also span the spectrum that runs from active to passive. In active sentences, the thing doing the action is the subject, and the thing receiving the action is the object. Passive sentences reverse this so that the object becomes the subject. As a result, someone who tends to use phrases such as, "the family planned the wedding," active, versus someone who would remember the event as, "the wedding was planned by the family," passive, have two very different feelings about how things work in life, two very different temperaments. Fourth, modals. Modal verbs, could, can, may, might, must, ought, shall, should, will, would, attach to core verbs to add qualities of modality, ability, possibility, obligation, permission, and the like. Modal phrases convey, 1. A character's sense of self and the world around him. 2. His feelings for his place in society and the interplay of relationships. 3. His view to the past, present, and future. 4. His attitudes toward what is possible, what is permitted, and what is necessary. Someone who says the family could plan the wedding versus someone who insists all weddings must be planned by families are probably two very different personalities. Principle of character-specific dialogue. Nouns and verbs express a character's intellectual life and range of knowledge. Modifiers, adjectives, adverbs, voice, modalities, express his emotional life and personality. To figure out how your character's personality expresses itself, ask, how does my character see life? Passive? Active? How does my character modify subjects and especially predicates? Before your fingers hit the keys, constantly ask, what words, phrases, and images would make my character's dialogue his alone? What in the psyche, life experience, and education of my character will express the content of his knowledge, names of nouns and verbs, and the one-of-a-kind mannerisms of his personality, modifiers and modalities. Culture and characterization. To answer these questions, consider this. Through the totality of your character's living hours, awake and sleeping, his or her mind, conscious and unconscious, has absorbed an immense and character-specific volume of culture, a combination of language, family, society, art, sport, religion, and the like. Year after year, life's events have hurt, rewarded, and influenced your character in countless ways. Into the sea of customs and encounters, the character has mixed the dispositions and physical givens he or she was handed at birth. Attractive, plain. Healthy, ailing. Aggressive, shy. High IQ, low IQ, and so on. The result is a specific admixture of genes and life experience that makes each character unlike any other character and gives him or her a singular voice. In the four case studies that follow, notice what their authors found when they entered into their characters' psyches. Popular culture. In the tragedy of Julius Caesar, Shakespeare references the Colossus of Rhodes, which was the most famous and certainly the largest bronze statue of the classical era, which in turn means that the well-traveled Cassius and Brutus must have sailed past it in awe. In Out of Sight, Elmore Leonard weaves images from 3 days of the Condor, a hit film in the Watergate era. His characters probably saw it in their impressionable teens. Passages from 30 Rock feature upper-class obsessions like yachts and mergers. Fine wine, on the other hand, is no longer the province of the rich. School teachers are as expert as sommeliers, which plays crucially in Sideways. To write each scene, the author has gone inside to see what his character has seen. He then discovered a cultural icon to enrich the scene as the character draws an analogy between his immediate life and a work of art or cuisine. Once again, using a third thing to create a trialogue. Think about it. How, in fact, do people express themselves in words? How do they explain what they're thinking and feeling, say what needs to be said, and most importantly, do what needs to be done? Answer? They use the bits and pieces of everything they know. And what, first and foremost, do they know? Culture. Whether popular or esoteric, whether acquired from formal education or overheard on a street corner, culture is our dominant source of knowledge. To that, we add all the imagery rooted in characters' encounters with nature, cityscapes, workscapes, and religious ritual, plus images from dreams, from fantasies about the future, from the totality of the day and night musings that weave these familiarities together. This massive experience creates a treasure chest of images that will inspire distinctive dialogue in the mouths of your characters. The next four case studies illustrate these principles. Chapter 11. Four Case Studies. The Tragedy of Julius Caesar. Consider this setup. Senator A is powerful and popular. The envious Senator B wants the respected Senator C to join forces against Senator A. So Senator B pulls Senator C aside to persuade him.
Senator A is so popular and so powerful that compared to him, we're nobodies.
Senator B states the obvious, impassive, opaque language. His dialogue could not be less persuasive, less imaginative, less interesting. The comparison he makes might irritate Senator C, but Senator B's words have no imagery to give them life, no subtext to give them depth. His complaint is so bland, Senator C could easily shrug it aside. Here's how history's greatest dialogue artist rendered the moment in The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2. Cassius says to Brutus,
"Why, man, he doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus, and we petty men walk under his huge legs and peep about to find ourselves dishonorable graves."
Shakespeare's Cassius hugely overstates the case, which, of course, is what people do when trying to wheedle their way inside somebody else's head. They use the techniques of rhetoric to distort, exaggerate, or manipulate. The Colossus was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. More than 100 feet tall, this bronze statue of the sun god Helios stood astride the harbor at Rhodes with ships sailing in and out of the port under its legs. Cassius compares Caesar to an awesome, imaginary colossus that would have one foot in Spain, the other in Syria, and the whole Mediterranean world between its legs. And yet, note that Shakespeare gives Cassius this phrase, "the narrow world." The instinctive, off-the-top-of-the-head phrase would be "the wide world." So why narrow? Because Shakespeare, I suspect, wrote in character. He slipped his imagination into the mind of Cassius so that he could work from Cassius's subjective point of view. He was then able to see the world the way Cassius saw it and write imagistic dialogue for the eye, the narrow world. As Roman senators, Cassius and Brutus would have imperial maps spread across their desks. Every week, they received strategic reports from all corners of the empire. These men know exactly how wide the world is, the width of all things Roman. To the naive, the world seems wide, but to these urbane politicos, it's narrow. So slender, in fact, a single man, the ambitious Caesar, could seize it and rule it alone. While immersing himself in his characters, Shakespeare must have imagined, even researched, their childhoods, for it was in their educations that he found his inspiration for crafting the play's unique dialogue. Aristocratic Roman schoolchildren were rigorously trained as orators, as future politicians skilled in the arts of declamation, persuasion, and rhetoric. And the guiding tenet of public speaking is, think as a wise man, but speak as a common man. Speak, in other words, in the plain, monosyllabic manner of the street. So note that of the 28 words in Cassius's sentence, only two have more than two syllables. Shakespeare knew that seasoned orators string short words together to create the effect of casual, artless, sincere ease while at the same time showing off their verbal ingenuity. For it takes skill to deliver monosyllables in a natural, pleasing rhythm. And Cassius is very clever. In fact, all of the play's characters have a way with simple words. The dialogue style throughout The Tragedy of Julius Caesar is almost exclusively monosyllabic, with some of Shakespeare's passages stringing 30 or more monosyllables in a row. What's more, as patrician senators, Cassius and Brutus have immense pride in their aristocratic heritage. The notion of seeming petty, of peeping about in search of a dishonorable grave, repels the noble Brutus. With these biting images, Cassius seduces him to assassinate Caesar. In terms of the modal side of dialogue, because Cassius is a bold, hard-thinking man on a mission, he uses direct action verbs, bestride, walk, peep. He does not modify his predicates. If he did, it might read like this.
It seems to me as if mighty Caesar could bestride the narrow world like some kind of gigantic colossus. So we poor men would have to walk carefully around under his huge legs and try to peep about to maybe, should we get really lucky, someday find ourselves disgusting, dishonorable graves.
This Cassius, as I've rewritten him, becomes weak and nervous. He's so preoccupied with what's possible and not possible, what's permitted and not permitted, what's sure and unsure, that he surrounds his verbs with could, would, should, and other cautious supplementary phrases. Lastly, very importantly, consider the background desires that surround Cassius and the gentlemanly restraints that shape his behavior. He knows that Brutus is a very private man, taciturn yet perceptive. Both men have been raised in an elite society in which cultured men do not bear their souls to each other. Therefore, to write in character, Shakespeare must have given thought and feeling to what his character would not say. For example, the refined Cassius would not speak on the nose.
I loathe that power-grabbing Caesar, and I know you hate the bastard too. So before we end up begging on our knees, kissing his tyrant's ass, let's murder the son of a bitch.
With the exception of hip-hop lyrics, the 21st century seems poetry light. Shakespearean iambic pentameter may feel out of reach. Nonetheless, we want our scenes to play with an intensity that matches the emotional lives of our characters and, in turn, moves the reader or audience. To achieve this, we take inspiration from Shakespeare to enrich our dialogue with imagery. First, we visualize the scene from our character's subjective point of view, and then find language within his nature and experience to create his character's specific dialogue. Out of sight. Consider this setup. During a prison break, a criminal forces a federal agent into the trunk of her car and climbs in with her. His partner takes the wheel and drives off. While sardined in the pitch-dark trunk, crook and cop are irresistibly attracted. After the getaway, neither can stop thinking about the other. Eventually, she tracks him to a hotel where, despite their antagonistic roles, their mutual passion moves them to declare a truce and spend a romantic evening together. Interior, luxury hotel room, night. Candlelight glints off the dewy eyes of the handsome criminal and the beautiful federal agent as they gaze longingly at each other.
I'm confused and scared.
Same here, but I'm trying to be cool.
Me too, but I'm afraid that you might rape me.
Never. My only hope is to have a nice romantic night together.
Good. Because underneath your tough exterior, I suspect there's a really loving guy. But still, I can't be certain. Maybe you're trying to seduce me, so I'll help you escape the law.
No. I understand you're still a federal agent, and I'm still a bank robber, and you have your job to do. It's just that you're so beautiful, I can't stop thinking about how it was when we met.
They sigh and take a sad sip of champagne. I've written this scene in the paralytic language of people saying exactly and completely what they think and feel. The result? A flattened wreck no actor could salvage. Explicit dialogue that turns a character's inner life into words turns an actor to wood. In contrast to the scene you just heard, here's how Elmore Leonard, one of the finest writers of dialogue in the modern novel, rendered the cop criminal tryst. In Chapter 20 of Out of Sight, escaped bank robber Jack Foley invites U.S. Marshal Karen Sisko to a hotel suite overlooking the Detroit waterfront. They drink and reminisce about the prison break and their dangerous, yet erotic encounter in the trunk of her car.
She said,
"Remember how talkative you were?"
He said, "I was nervous," lighting her cigarette and then his own.
"Yeah, but you didn't show it. You were a pretty cool guy. But then when you got in the trunk, I thought you'd try to tear my clothes off."
It never entered my mind. Well, not until... Remember we were talking about Faye Dunaway? I told you I liked that movie, 3 Days of the Condor, and you said, yeah, you love the lines. Like, the next morning after they'd slept together, he says he'll need her help, and she says...
"Have I ever denied you anything?"
I thought for a couple of seconds there, the way you said it, you were coming on to me.
Maybe I was and didn't know it. Before they ever go to bed, she accused him of getting rough. He says, "What? Have I raped you?" And she says, "The night is young." I thought, come on. What is she doing? Giving him ideas? You know you kept touching me, feeling my thigh.
Yeah, but in a nice way.
You called me your Zuzu.
That's candy. Inside, something sweet.
In this deceptively simple but complex scene, Leonard's dialogue creates multiple layers of textural imagery over a double layer of implied images. The first two layers are set up in the previous pages. Layer one, the image of the setting. For his long fantasized rendezvous with Karen, Foley chooses a posh hotel suite that commands a panorama of the city at night under a gentle snowfall. Soft lights, soft music. They're posed like a chic couple on a Royal Crown whiskey billboard. Leonard delights in setting up this glitzy cliché so he can ironize it and undercut it again and again. Layer two. The all-too-familiar image of the situation. Their romance is illegal. Foley is a felon on the run, Sisko is the law. But this has been done many times before. McQueen and Dunaway in the Thomas Crown Affair, Bogey and Bacall in Dark Passage, Grant and Hepburn in Charade. It's not just any cliché. It's a movie cliché. And then the dialogue takes over to add more facets. Layer three, escape from reality. Over their movie scene, Foley and Sisko superimpose yet another movie, 3 Days of the Condor. They chat about their favorite moments from the film because they're fully aware that they're living in a virtual film. As a result, the reader blends the famous faces of Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway with the fictional faces of Foley and Sisko, coating the whole episode with Hollywood gloss. Layer four, the memory. The lovers replay their intimate adventure in her car trunk. This takes us back to the mini-movie that ran through our head when we read the prison break scene in the opening chapters. Now, four layers of images are superimposed on the reader's mind. The hotel setting, the cop criminal situation, the Hollywood version, and the burnished nostalgia of how they met. But that's only the surface. Beneath this, Leonard creates his characters' inner lives of unspoken needs and dreams. Leonard uses a pair of third things. 3 days of the Condor and the memory of their first adventure. These play back to back to create interlocking trialogues. As I laid out in part two, working a scene through a third thing helps keep dialogue off the nose. Layer five, the subtext. Under the lines, we sense Jack and Karen's desire to put aside their cop criminal roles, to take time out from life so they can indulge this rush of romance. We can well imagine their sexual fantasies clashing with the realization that their intimacy is tabooed. This, in turn, makes their sensual desires dangerous, even lethal, and so all the more erotic. Could either of them name what they're feeling? No. No one could and still feel it.